This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm with Dr. Scott Ransom. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
Glad to have you with us. So you're visiting at Manchester University for a couple of days. So your main area of study is pulsars.
That's right.
And would you like to just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background in astrophysics?
Sure. So my name's Scott Ransom. I'm an astronomer at the National Radio Astronomy Astronomical, I should say, observatory in the U.S. We run the big radio telescopes that are there, the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, and especially what a lot of people know about is the Very Large Array in New Mexico, which was in the movie Contact and stuff. I'm also at the University of Virginia, where I work with some students there. But as you said, my main research interest is pulsars. So I do all sorts of neutron star stuff and pulsar stuff, however much I can, because I totally love them.
Yeah, I mean, one of my memories is listening to a talk that you gave, which was basically just called Pulsars Are Awesome. So could you remind our listeners, because we do have quite a few people to come on here that talk about pulsars and pulsar-related things, because this is Jodrell Banks, so
that's right.
We like our pulsars. But maybe just a quick refresher for our listeners as to sort of, you know, what a pulsar is, basic facts, and why it's kind
sure.
of interesting.
Yeah, so a pulsar is basically what happens after a massive star exhausts all of its nuclear fuel during its lifetime. So it collapses, the center of the star collapses, and the star explodes in a supernova, and the neutron star is basically the stellar undead, the corpse of that star, basically, that's left over. So in general, we see them right after the supernovae. And they only last usually for a few tens of millions of years. And the reason we call them pulsars is because they're rotating, just like a figure skater when she pulls her arms in, when you take the slowly rotating core of a star and it collapses into something the size of a city, because these are neutron stars, which are tiny, about the size of a city. They rotate pretty rapidly, and because they have strong magnetic fields, that causes beams of radiation. So like a lighthouse, we see pulses of radiation. And then that's the general picture of what a pulsar is. And my particular kind of specialty, the things that I really like are a kind of an exotic flavor of pulsars known as the millisecond pulsars, which can spin hundreds of times per second.
Okay, so that's the basic lowdown on pulsars. And what are they useful for? I mean, at first glance, they're just kind of cool, rare objects in the universe, but I guess there's a reason that so many astronomers and astrophysicists want to study these things, apart from the fact that they're really rare.
Yeah, no, they're truly amazing objects. So if you study just the objects themselves, they're extraordinary. They're, like I said, they're the size of a city. They can be rotating hundreds of times per second. They have the strongest magnetic fields we know of in the universe. Their gravities are billions of times the surface gravity of the Earth. They're basically gigantic nuclei. I mean, there's the amount of exoticness of these objects goes on and on and on. But even if you forget about all those things, they'd still be really interesting objects to study because of the fact that they spin so perfectly. They're like these ultra-dense flywheels in space, and nothing is there to slow them down except for the radiation that they're giving off. And so because they're spinning so perfectly, we can use them as basically natural, perfect clocks. And when you have a ticking beacon out there, it lets us map things out, lets us track things over time that we just simply couldn't do unless we went out there and put a device like a clock, exactly
sure,
like the pulsar is doing it itself. So even just forgetting about the fact that they're incredibly exotic, their use as tools is what makes a lot of people just find them fascinating and useful.
Cool. So correct me if I'm wrong, but that means that you can use them to study tiny variations in space-time and that sort of thing because
Absolutely.
You've got a really regular signal?
Yeah, so one of the big projects that's going on internationally, and Jodrell Bank is part of it, my organization is part of it, are these things called pulsar timing arrays. And there's three big groups which are kind of collaborating and competing at the same time. And together we joined to be called the International Pulsar Timing Array. And we're using the biggest radio telescopes in the world to track the pulses from about 50 or 60, even more than that now, almost 70, I think, millisecond pulsars. Looking for exactly what you said, tiny little deviations in the ticks of their clocks that we think, if we measure them correctly, are going to show that the universe is kind of stretching and compressing due to gravitational waves, which is exactly what Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts.
Yeah. So literally, these things are so precise that if something goes wrong, it's not the pulsar's fault, it's the space around it.
That's right. And the amount of the wiggle in those arrival times is ridiculously small. As the pulses are traveling, there are thousands of light years from the pulsar to us.
Yeah.
These big wiggles in space-time, the ripples in space-time, cause the pulses to only change their arrival times by a couple tens of nanoseconds. So that's a tens of billionth of a second. And our timing precision is so good that, at least on some pulsars, we can actually get down to that level, which is astonishing.
So maybe could you like take us into how you actually achieve that kind of precision? Because, I mean, you're not using, obviously, stopwatches, but like, how do you get to this kind of, I mean, I'm assuming it's way smaller than nanoseconds. It's like 10 to the minus 15 seconds or something like that.
When you look at the total fractional error, so to speak, so if we look at the amount of time error we get by observing a pulsar for a long amount of time, mm-hmm. so what's the smallest amount of time deviation over, say, 10 years?
Yeah.
That number is about 10 to the 15, so 15 wow. orders of magnitude. And that comes from this amazing technique known as pulsar timing. And basically what happens is we are unambiguously counting every single rotation of the neutron star. And these are the millisecond pulsars that are spinning hundreds of times per second.
Okay.
So that means that we have to count billions and billions and billions of these rotations perfectly without missing a single one mm-hmm. by using these really, really large telescopes. And just to do that, it means we have to track the motion of the Earth, the motion of the observatory, the motion of the pulsar to incredible precision, or else we're going to miss ticks of the clock, so sure. to speak, from the pulsar. But the neat thing is once you get it right, mm-hmm. and it takes, you have to observe in a very special sequence in order to establish what we call the pulsar timing solution. But once you do that, you kind of lock into a solution and you can basically go away for months even without even measuring the star. And when you come back, the ticks appear exactly where you expect them to.
Brilliant.
And you know exactly how many pulses or how many times the neutron star rotated.
That's really cool. So yeah, you mentioned big telescopes. One of the particularities of pulsar observations is that you just basically want the biggest telescope you can get to see
Absolutely.
Them, right?
Yeah.
So that means you get pretty cool telescopes. So there's, tell us a bit about which telescopes you usually
yeah.
use.
So exactly what you said, big telescopes are crucial for pulsar astronomers because pulsars are really, really faint objects in the radio. There was some, I'll probably get the details of this number screwed up, so maybe if anyone's listening to the podcast, they can send me an email and correct me if they calculate the right number, but it's something like if you take and measure the total amount of energy that all the radio telescopes have ever measured from all the pulsars we know about, it's equivalent to like two or three falling snowflakes or something. That's the amount of energy. So yeah, they're incredibly faint. And so I use the Big Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. It's 100 meters diameter, and it's fully steerable, which really helps because we can see a lot of the pulsars in the southern hemisphere, which is where most of the pulsars are.
Okay.
And then the other amazing telescope that we use is the Arecibo Telescope, which is built into the ground as seen in the James Bond movie, whichever one that is,
GoldenEye.
Yeah. And so it's built into the ground, and it's 300 meters in diameter, which gives it incredible sensitivity. So for pulsar people, basically, if there's a pulsar in the sky, and if Arecibo can see it, that's the one you want to use because it's going to give you by far the best data of any other telescope.
Sure. So going back to the comment you made about how you see most pulsars in the southern hemisphere, and kind of leading on from that, if they're so faint, how do you even find them in the first place?
Right. So the whole pulsar search process, how we do that is, that's one of my specialties and one of the things I concentrate most on.
Okay.
It's a tricky, tricky problem. And every big major single-dish radio telescope in the world right now is basically part of a big pulsar survey because people have realized how useful these things are for physics, so we want to find more of them. But it's a really tricky problem, and it uses a huge amount of computing because what we have to do is you take these big telescopes and you point at a single point on the sky, and usually that size of that point on the sky is smaller than the size of the moon, for instance, substantially smaller usually.
Yeah.
And you can put a lot of full moons across the sky.
Well, so. Yeah. I was going to say that even in astronomy, the moon is considered pretty big on the sky.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. So even for that one pixel, if it's, say, a quarter the size of the moon or something, we basically have like radio channels, just like the radio in your car or something, but we'll have thousands of frequency channels that we monitor, and we take data about every 20,000 times per second on every one of those thousands of frequency channels. And that means we're taking gigabytes of data every minute. And so these surveys take petabytes of data. So that's a really large amount of data,
yeah.
1,000 terabytes. And in order to process it, because these are incredibly faint signals and tons of noise, it really is a needle in a haystack type problem. So there's very special algorithms and software that people have written. As a matter of fact, my PhD thesis was writing a big suite of software to do pulsar searches.
Sure.
So then you throw a big, massive supercomputer at all this huge amount of data and then generate millions of candidates, which might be pulsars.
Right.
And unfortunately, only about one in every 10,000 or one in every 100,000 of those millions of candidates turns out to be a pulsar. So it really is an incredible computational and sifting problem. But then you find some really amazing things when you do it right.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so if I'm not wrong, I think steps have been taken to try and automate this process a bit more from getting from like millions of candidates and sifting those out using computers and machine learning.
Right.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a big research effort going on right now by a bunch of different groups to use various types of machine learning because as we've increased the amount of data we generate, the amount of candidate potential pulsars, that number's gone up just as fast or
sure.
even faster.
Yeah.
And so it used to be that a poor graduate student would have to look at you know, hundreds or thousands of plots. But a graduate student now can't look at millions of plots. So we really do have to think of new ways to have the computer sift through all the chaff so we can get the wheat.
Nice. But I'm going to come back to another thing you said, which is sort of, so say you point your telescope at this tiny patch of sky. How do you know that it's that patch of sky? Or does every patch of sky have equal chances of containing pulsars?
Okay, so that's a great question. So several types of searches that are going on right now. In general, millisecond pulsars, the ones we really want to find, they tend to be quite nearby us in the galaxy.
Okay.
And so it's just like most of the stars you can see with your naked eye. In general, we see no real preference of which direction stars are in the sky.
Yeah.
So we have to look everywhere. And that's what makes these things take petabytes of data. But the center of our galaxy, so most of the stars, if you get your binoculars out, most of the stars are actually towards the southern hemisphere because that's where the center of our galaxy is.
Sure.
And since pulsars come from massive stars, most of the pulsars tend to reside towards the direction of the center of the galaxy, and that's why the southern hemisphere has more than the northern hemisphere does. But that's kind of for the slower pulsars. The millisecond pulsars, in general, at least the ones that we want to measure, are closer to us, and so they're kind of all over the sky. So that's why we have to search in every direction.
Okay. And could you not pick up different types of radiation, because given that they're kind of dying stars-ish, or they appear sort of when a star collapses, are there not other signatures that could lead you to say, oh, there's going to be a pulsar over here?
Absolutely. And there's kind of become a little cottage industry of figuring out ways to find the best spots on the sky in which to look for pulsars. And what thing you mentioned is when you have a massive star and it dies in a supernova, it leaves behind, for instance, a supernova remnant.
Yeah.
So one of the things that people have done in the past is basically every supernova remnant that we see, people have pointed big radio telescopes at the center of the supernova remnant looking to see if there's a pulsar in the center, and they've been very successful. Many supernova remnants have those. Another thing that's been really great in the last 5 or 6 years for millisecond pulsars, and this was a surprise, we didn't know this, was that it turns out that almost all millisecond pulsars give off gamma rays as well as radio waves. And about 5 years ago, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope was launched, and it has been surveying the whole sky in gamma rays, and it's found these gamma ray point sources scattered all over the sky that weren't associated with known galaxies or anything else. So we started pointing radio telescopes at these Fermi gamma ray point sources and finding millisecond pulsars,
nice,
which are exactly what we're trying to search over the whole sky for. But it's like Fermi basically gave us little X marks the spots on the sky and gave us a place to dig for treasure, kind of. So it's been really useful.
Wow.
And using that technique, we found over 60 new millisecond pulsars, which is amazing.
Okay, so actually that brings up another question. How many are there? Like, how rare are these things? Like, you say 60 is a lot, so I'm assuming that there can't be more than a few hundred.
That's right. So regular pulsars, the ones that spin about once per second, the ones that are tens of millions of years old after supernovas and stuff, we know of about 2,300 of those, a little bit more than 2,000 in our galaxy. We think the galaxy contains about 30,000, so we only know of less than 10% in our galaxy.
Is that because the others are too weak to be detected?
That's right.
Okay.
Yep, so that's why we need those bigger telescopes.
Fair enough.
For the millisecond pulsars, it's a little bit of a coincidence, actually. Mm-hmm. We think there's roughly about 30,000 or a few tens of thousand millisecond pulsars in our galaxy as well, but we only know of about 200 of them, maybe 300. We might be up to 300. And so to have Fermi find us 60 of those, and these other surveys found us about another 50 in the last few years, that it means that we've doubled. That's actually much more than that. In the last 10 years, we've quadrupled the number of millisecond pulsars that we've known about. And just in the last 5 years, we've more than doubled.
Wow.
And a lot of that's been due to Fermi. So it's a big improvement.
Awesome. So basically, the discovery of gamma rays coming from pulsars was a coincidence, because the Fermi people were like, what are these point sources? And then realized they're pulsars. So do we know much actually about how the emission mechanism works and how it gives off? So we know it gives off radio waves and now gamma rays, but do we know actually a little bit about how these things work on the inside, or is it a bit of a mystery?
Yes to both those. We know a little bit. So in a very kind of hand-wavy way, we know how they work. But the details, even though we've known about pulsars for over 40 years now, the details are still quite a mystery. So the basic mechanism, which we can explain here, is quite well known. And so the idea is you have a strong magnetic field. So just like the magnetic field you get on a refrigerator magnet or something, or a bar magnet. You've seen all these pictures of the way a bar magnet has these magnetic field lines that go out of one end and come back in the other.
Yeah.
And if you take that bar magnet and you start rotating it, but not necessarily on its correct axis so that it's tilted, then you have this a misaligned magnetic field, basically, that's moving. And one of the neat things about the way electromagnetics work is that every time you move a magnetic field, you generate an electric field.
Yeah.
And so this rotating neutron star with a moving massive magnetic fields is generating these huge, incredibly strong electric fields. Mm-hmm. And those electric fields rip charges off the surface of the neutron star. So electrons and positrons get ripped off the surface of the neutron star and accelerated to incredibly fast velocities, right near the speed of light.
Right.
And as they're moving near the speed of light, they're moving along the magnetic field lines. And one of the things that happens with an electron whenever it curves like that at very high velocities is it gives off radiation. So that acceleration causes high amounts of radiation, and sometimes the energies are so strong that radiation, which tends to be gamma rays, can create other particles, which then are accelerated. So you get these massive cascades of particles that generate more gamma rays, and this cascade of radiation then it gets beamed out, and then they also all wiggle together and create radio waves, etc. It's a very complicated process, but we think we understand basically how it's working.
Okay, sure. But the nature of pulsars themselves means that you can do something like take the spectrum of a pulsar, you can like study its radiation as it varied, like by a long wavelength, basically.
Or people have tried.
Okay.
But yeah, there's no spectral lines, for instance, like you'd see from an optical star.
No, sure, yeah.
And the reason for it is that this type of acceleration mechanism where you accelerate these charged particles, some particles get accelerated slightly less than others, so they're each giving off slightly different radiation. So you see a very smooth,
continuous,
kind of featureless, it's a continuum, rather than spectral lines. That's exactly right.
Sure. Okay, cool. And to kind of try and wrap things up, so what's the next big discovery that pulsars want to make? So gravitational waves, you mentioned, are like basically a big goal. So who's going to get there first, LIGO or pulsars?
Well, I mean, advanced LIGO, basically they're now in the last stages of bringing the advanced LIGO, which is a major upgrade to the LIGO facilities. Mm-hmm. They're bringing that online over the next year or two, and it'll probably take a full year to shake it down and get the detectors working perfectly. But they're already ahead of schedule. They're doing great.
Oh, wow, okay.
So truthfully, LIGO will probably detect something in, let's say, roughly 2 to 3 years from now.
Cool.
Which is great. Our chances of detecting something within 2 to 3 years is slim. It's possible, but it's slim. So I think we're kind of a dark horse. You know, we're a potential dark horse contender.
Okay.
But I wouldn't bet a lot of money on us right now to be the first.
Well, actually, I reckon it's probably almost as good to be second because independent confirmation.
Yeah, that's right. And the neat thing about it is the LIGO stuff is very different part of the gravitational wave spectrum. So it's completely different sources. It's like being able to see in X-rays compared to radio waves or compared, you know, optical light compared to gamma rays.
Yeah,
it's completely
different
objects we see in each of those bands.
Sure. That's great. Well, Scott, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks
a lot for coming along, and hope to see you around soon.
Sure.
Cheers.